Hi, how are you? This is Brett. Today is Tuesday, March 24th, and I am still in southern New Hampshire for now. You are about to hear a conversation with Paul Verge. Paul is a friend, a filmmaker, and he is one of the founding members of the Tragedy and Hope community. He was there right from the beginning. He actually worked with Richard Grove before Tragedy and Hope was a thing. And I met Paul 10 years ago. And I saw him for the last time last summer at the Red Pill Expo in Connecticut. We had such a great time together that I said, man, I got to find a way to get Paul back on the show. But what could we talk about? I'm sorry. It's this. Paul is in Vancouver, British Columbia. And he has already, after his wife was exposed at a conference to somebody who tested positive for coronavirus, he already spent a period of 2 weeks under quarantine. And people are using that word quarantine kind of loosely right now, but he was like put under quarantine. And he will tell that story on the show today. I've always found Paul to be a very soothing presence. So I was happy that we actually could, even though I wish we didn't have to talk about this, I was happy that I could talk to him about this situation. I hope you're doing well. And I'm going to throw this out there, and I want to see what kind of a response I get. I understand if people have other concerns or priorities right now, but if you are a parent of home-educated, unschooled children, I would be very interested in interviewing them. So if your son or daughter is in this situation and they're looking for something new to do, please hit me up, brett@schoolsucksproject.com. We'll set something up. I think it's important. We use this platform to project a picture of what learning at home actually looks like and why people find so much joy and satisfaction in it. It's very sad that very loosely speaking, the model of education we've been proposing on this show for a decade, with all of its benefits, has at this point been basically imposed, right? It has become compulsory, ironically, for the entire country, which, as you know, with the previous form of compulsory schooling, not a recipe for a lot of enjoyment. So I'd like to be able to do an ongoing presentation about models of why this is actually such a fulfilling way to live and to learn, because, you know, people are going to be doing it for a while. You know, I think it would be really sad if 2 months from now, 4 months from now, a year from now, whenever it's going to be, if it's going to be at all, that parents across the country actually breathe a sigh of relief when they get to load their children back onto stuffy, crowded yellow buses and transport them to the germ factories and the shooting galleries that we call America's public schools. So in addition to hi, how are you, this is something I'd like to get going as soon as possible. And obviously, I will need the help of the School Sucks community. So again, brett@schoolsucksproject.com. I hope to hear from you. Let's get these set up. So that's it. Here's my conversation with Paul Verge. Thanks for listening and take care out there. Thank you for coming on School Sucks.
Thanks for having me on. Hi. How are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I have had lots of ups and downs, but yeah. It kind of levels out. So I can say that I'm feeling functional, trying to be the anchor for my family.
Yeah.
In terms of their emotional well-being and really physical well-being. And just having a lot of conversations, like maybe this one, where it's catching up with people I haven't talked to in a while. Or I've had a lot of people reach out to me asking me, like, hey, what's a reliable source of info right now?
Yeah. Well, I think we'll get into that a little bit on the show today. And as you know, I mean, we talked over the summer. I saw you in June. You know, I was like, God, I got to find a reason to get Paul back on the show. I'm sorry it came to this, but when I thought about having these conversations, you were one of the first people that I thought of. And, I think we're going to explore a lot of angles of this today, but I just wanted to introduce, like, obviously we have a lot of newer people in the audience. So you actually are from a bit of a different era of School Sucks. We probably started working together, collaborating, like doing podcasts and stuff, like 2010, 2011. Last time I think you were on the show was like 2013. We did a show on the Brain software, but we had worked together a bunch before that. And do you remember how we met?
how we first like met in person or
not in person, virtually? Like the first, our first virtual meeting.
I think it was you being interviewed by proxy for a film I was working on back in 2009, 2010, just after Tragedy and Hope had started, and you and Rich had connected. And then, we were having these conversations, some recorded, some not. And I remember just because I had to edit so much of the great stuff you had to say for my second film, that which didn't end up being finished, that I felt like I had more of a one-way relationship where it's like, oh, I've listened to Brett talk for hours.
Yeah.
And he doesn't really know me that well. So I do remember, I'm pretty sure that was it, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Virtually, at least. I definitely remember our first in-person meeting and that whole weekend.
So it was a film called Believers Beware. And you were in Canada, where you are now. And I was, I lived in New Hampshire at the time. So I drove down to Rich and Lisa's house in Connecticut, and Rich filmed me in his living room while you talked to me on Skype. And that was the first time I think I ever met them in person too.
Oh, wow.
So that was back in the day. And then you cut a trailer for it. And I remember I've ribbed you about this a bunch, but I was right up against David Icke in the trailer.
Yeah. Because I thought you guys were so similar in terms of the quality of your work that I was like, oh, maybe some of Ike's good luck will rub off on Brett. But, you know, it goes the way it does. So there's still the 45-minute sort of early cut that's online still, where it has more of you than David Icke, but you talking about, you know, how to deflate somebody's belief system by asking them questions and talking about just real basic philosophy stuff. So
right. Nice.
It was good.
Yeah, I definitely want to see it someday. And when was our first in-person meeting? Was it Porkfest?
Yeah, it was Porkfest when we pulled up to that rest stop. And you were like, oh, hey, Paul Virg in Richard's car. Or no, I was driving the
Lincoln.
The classic. The Lincoln, that's right. Town Lincoln's car. Parked. That's right.
Yes.
We had our a couple of Lincolns. And that was a very memorable week for me. Got to meet a lot of cool people, but obviously you were the one person I was really looking forward to meeting in person and having conversations with. So we ended up sharing a room, I remember correctly.
Oh yeah, that was so weird. Yeah. There was it was in that, I had never been in that hotel, and every time I ever went to Porkfest and I camped there, I always thought, man, that hotel looks nice. And we got a room, and I remember I had an air mattress, and there were like two queen beds in there, and we lined up all the beds so they all touched each other going across the room. Air mattress, queen bed, and I think like what? Yeah, like three or four of us slept in there. It was it was a hoot. It was one of the last times I smoked pot. One of the last three times where I wanted a drag. Somebody handed me a spliff. I forgot what I was doing. I was in the middle of a conversation. I just started smoking it like a cigarette. And then I realized, like, I don't know what this conversation is about. I don't know who these people are that I'm talking to. And I just ran away. And I went back to that hotel room. And I said, if I eat, I'll feel better. And the only thing in there was corn chips. And I started eating corn chips until my mouth was just a desert. And then I had to leave that room. And, I'm not a very practiced pot smoker, but that was not an encouraging experience. What was that, like 2016, 2000? I think that was 2017,
I want to say 2017, yeah.
Yeah. So can you just, for people who are unfamiliar, can you just talk a little bit too about how you kind of became involved with Richard Grove and the whole Tragedy and Hope thing?
Sure.
Yeah.
So I started off being fairly apolitical, ended up trying to cross the border in 2003 with a David Icke book and got held at the border and questioned about it. It kind of opened my eyes. Like, I wasn't going to take it seriously. These border people took it seriously. So I read it with a little more discerning mind. That got me onto the whole 9/11 thing, which leads down a whole bunch of rabbit holes. But eventually by 2006, I want to say, I had gotten in contact with Richard Grove when I heard his Project Constellation podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And he had inspired me to do my own kind of film. This is pre-Zeitgeist. So I wanted to do a film about 9/11, but also the socioeconomic system and how that was all working together to, you know, cause some issues for humanity. And once I got funding for that film, Rich was the first person I reached out to, and he agreed to be interviewed for the film. And he actually let me fly out to Connecticut, and him and Lisa put me up in their apartment in Hartford at the time. And that was our first meeting and getting to know each other. And from there, the friendship just grew into the creation of Tragedy and Hope, which I helped with the initial magazine version of mm-hmm. that project, which Rich evolved into the website that exists today. Can you hear a phone ringing?
People can hear the phone ringing, and I think everybody understands that you are... They don't know this yet, but they will be very understanding once I tell them that you are doing work in an empty office and there is no one there to answer that phone wherever it is. So we'll just have to deal with it. Maybe I can soap it out. I don't know. But
I was going to say I should just go unplug it, but it's cool. It's, whoever's calling, I'm sure will stop.
Right.
So once I got funding and I met Rich and we finished the first film, which was called Hijacking Humanity, went on to do a little tour of that one and started the second film, Believers Beware. Again, flew out to visit Rich and Lisa. Did a road trip that time, driving all the way from Vancouver to New York and down to Connecticut. And this time I got to interview like David Icke and all these interesting sort of wacky people. But that film ended up not being completed for a variety of reasons, but one was sort of a shift I made personally, and a lot of the people I had interviewed I was no longer in agreement with. And so that, coupled with a catastrophic hard drive failure, kind of diminished my passion to finish that. And so I've done some other projects, but one of the things that came out of that was working with Tragedy and Hope, doing projects like What You've Been Missing, and then podcasts with Peace Revolution, and ultimately connecting with you and School Sucks once we got into the John Taylor Gatto kind of stuff. So yeah. I was an associate producer on the Ultimate History Lesson. And my mom's a teacher. My grandma was a preschool teacher. So once you and I connected, or I at least got to connect with your work, that opened my eyes to what I thought was like sort of the final missing piece to putting a big puzzle together, which is indoctrination via education.
Right. Absolutely. And I thought your story would be like a useful running start to, I think, at least some features of our conversation here, where people, when we talk about Tragedy and Hope, when we talk about these various projects, and we talk about the topics that these projects covered, people get a sense of what our, at least, you know, our worldview is when we look at, you know, catastrophic and catalyzing events like 9/11, right? Mm-hmm. Now, when 9/11 happened, I was 23. I had virtually no awareness of anything that was happening in the world. I know you were a little younger than that. And, you know, I think even from that place of ignorance, there was enough alertness to know that this was an event that was going to change the world. Right. And we're clearly living right now through an event that is going to have an even bigger impact on the world, maybe longer term. And it's interesting to kind of like, for me anyway, to look at the kinds of finger quotes outreach that I did after 9/11. We're talking years after 9/11, like the 5th anniversary rolls around, the 10th anniversary rolls around, and what my affect was as far as like trying to communicate some of this stuff to people. And now here we are in another situation that's far more challenging. That my girlfriend and I were talking about this the other day, and she said it feels like every day is 9/11. You know, and I get that, you know, so there's an extra challenge in wanting to, you know, like we're doing here, trying to practice calm, but also alertness about what is happening. And it's a really, really delicate balance. And I just wanted to, because you had all this experience for as long as I have with these things, but you actually, you know, ran into an experience earlier this month that I wanted to give you a chance to talk about, of actually being quarantined for being sick in Canada. And so that happens to you with all of this knowledge of the world that, you know, in situations like that can certainly turn into, I don't want to say like, it's not paranoia and maybe it's not even fear, but you're definitely coming at it from a place of, oh, the government's here and I don't believe that they're necessarily going to help me. So that must have been, you know, I don't know, like a pretty
upsetting thing to have to go through. So I just wanted to hear you tell that story of mm-hmm. how it happened. Now this is Canada and maybe most people are in the United States, but I am feeling like there's lots of people listening to this who are going to know somebody that this happens to, or they're at least going to have to provide support for somebody that this happens to, or that somebody knows somebody that this is going to happen to. So yeah, I just wanted to hear your story, whatever you wanted to share about it.
Sure. Well, I work at a popular film studio in Vancouver, and I was recently married in actually just a month and a half ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I think you got a chance to meet
my
lovely wife at mm-hmm. the Red Pill Expo. So anyways, she was at an event on March 6th called the Pacific Dental Conference. And it's Western Canada, or at least Western, the biggest dental conference, I guess, that goes on during the year. And thousands of people, lots of events. And they rent out a huge, not a banquet hall, but a conference center. And I guess what happened was there's an attendee who had flown in from either Iran or China. Was a dentist, and he later tested positive for COVID-19. And based on that, they informed my wife, told her that anyone that she was in contact with could be potentially carrying this. And so as part of a sort of duty of care, I informed my work the day I found out, because I had also shown some symptoms of just having a cold, right? Mm. And she had also developed a sore throat and a cough, and I gave them the full situation with the confirmed PDC attendee. And up until that point, up until, let's say, March 9th or 10th, there had been awareness of this, viral outbreak, but there wasn't what I would classify now as the sort of like developing panic, which, so I was quarantined. My work said, okay, you got to stay home for at least 14 days. I live with my son and my wife and my brother and my brother's wife in mm-hmm. a 3-bedroom apartment. And my brother and my son both work here at the studio. So my wife sent home, I'm sent home. The next day, both my brother and my son are sent home. My brother's wife gets sick. And so at that point, we're like, oh gosh, what should we do? So our work instructs us to call 811, which is in BC, that's the health hotline.
Yeah.
That you're supposed to call if you're feeling symptoms and want to get some advice. So I was calling 811 for like 5 hours, finally get through, describe my symptoms. They're like, yeah, that's probably just a cold. You don't need to leave and get tested. Up until that point, I guess they were getting people to go get tested, but didn't want to cause a panic. So today is my first day back, because I've never developed a flu and I no longer have any symptoms. However, what I noticed last week, as this news started spreading, so did the only thing that seemed more contagious than this virus was people's sense of what am I going to do and uncertainty. And so you would go to the store and suddenly there's no toilet paper, or you go to another store and suddenly there's no meat to buy. And you go to another store and there's no canned goods. And we have just as good of a supply chain as the US. We have way less population, so it's a little less condensed. And so I was like, we definitely have enough product to like service everyone. It must be panic buying. And so there's like a lot of news stories, specifically from British Columbia, about people being caught on camera and then shamed for bulk buying the entire stock of meat or toilet paper, whatever, in a store, and then cancel culture descends on those people and starts shaming them, which, you know, fair enough. But it took a while before stores were like, okay, we're only going to let you get 2 Costco sized toilet papers instead of like 20. And so they're instituting their way to combat emerging sense of panic. But what I noticed, I mean, there's a couple of areas we could branch off to, but I started reading online. I started noticing there's a big focus on the count, the illness count, the death count, all this stuff. Not a lot of discussion about this flu in relation to other flus in years past, which have been responsible for many, many ill people and deaths. So I'm a bit suspicious, or where my suspicion grew the most is, you know, I'm expecting this to be a 2020 overreaction to what I would think is a mild pandemic. But then I went on Reddit and I saw Bill Gates had done an Ask Me Anything. And the top question was, how do you think society is going to shift in order to verify which people are carrying the disease and who isn't, and who's been vaccinated and who hasn't? And Bill Gates had a prepared answer, which if you want, I can find while we're talking, but essentially he implied that movement may need to be restricted absent some kind of digital certificate to prove whether you've been vaccinated or not. And I feel like that's an agenda that many people in certain circles have wanted to put in for quite a while.
And I would just jump in and say, right now, like as things develop and as there's a lot of uncertainty, I would certainly be very accepting of a never let a crisis go to waste kind of approach to all of these things, where there's going to be environmental implications, there's going to be economic implications, there's going to be health system implications, and there's a lot of agendas that have been waiting in the wings. And like, if you don't have, you know, a hot country versus country, or country versus rogue terrorist kind of war to fight, this is an opportunity where a lot of things that had waited in the wings would be implemented. I certainly wouldn't rush. And I do at this point, I try to kind of studiously avoid these things where, number one, if I go and collect this information, what good is it at a time? If I discover the suitcase with the secrets of coronavirus in it, let's just say,
what good
is it? Even from a platform where I could reach thousands and thousands of people very easily. This is tough. And usually I can edit out the parts where I have to think about the shit that I'm saying, but I'm not editing these. So sorry, everybody.
I think I know what you mean.
Yeah. Everybody, all the recipients of the information right now are in a very elevated state of fear, right? So it's not a time for outreach, but if you can project calm and not like fake it, like actually, and I'm still trying to find this balance. Like, I don't know if I freaked out on people, but I was definitely like a little too hyper-vigilant in the very like distanced interactions that I had with humans over the last couple of days. Especially when I see people not taking it seriously. Like I want to act as if the people like in my Facebook feed who I trust, or the not the mainstream media, but the people who are really like sounding the alarm, like the first conversation I had with my friend Nick Runlett, I'm acting as if his level of concern is accurate when I'm out in public. But also as a person who suffers, like not suffers, but deals with a fair amount of health anxiety, you know, like I try to regulate that the best I can. But sometimes, you know, I just wake up in the morning and a voice in my head says, are we going to get cancer from eating bacon? You know, like it's something. And this is not a good situation for somebody who has that voice in their head to be in. Right. So to comfort myself, you know, it is things like the Diamond Princess cruise, right, which is basically, you know, this petri dish, as the New York Times calls it, for the disease, 83%. And now I think enough time has passed to know 83% of people on that ship walked away uninfected. The death rate of the 17% that were infected was fairly low. A lot of the people were elderly. They had pre-existing conditions. So, you know, even if in those moments of health anxiety, I feel short of breath like an anxious person does, or I think I get a sniffle in the dead of winter. I'm looking out the window right now. It's like there's a snowstorm here. So, and you know, I talked to a really good friend of mine the other day who was concerned about this. We were just texting back and forth. I called him immediately. I said, look, man, I get it. I know what that feels like. I know what that worry feels like. So it's all just this matter of trying to balance these things. But you said you thought you knew where I was going. So please take me there.
Well, in terms of the thing that to me is more infectious than any viral load is fear. And so I was trying to contextualize reading this Bill Gates thing with what my immediate reaction was versus a couple of days going by. I decided not to like broadcast that out to the world and try, because I, like you were saying, what good does that information do for anyone who's already in that heightened state? Nothing. It might send them over the edge, might make them more paranoid, might make them go, oh my God, what's to come? So my middle brother is a psych nurse, and he works in a hospital just outside Vancouver. And so I've been getting my fact-based health-related questions and answers with him. Because he can tell me, like, he can't tell me details of patients, but he can be like, yeah, there's a lot of people in for this, or the signs are like this. And if anyone's like going to get this disease, it's healthcare workers, and he's one of them. So I took some time to question with him about past quote unquote pandemics and what the ramp up was, what the peak was, and what the die down was. And because we've had these scares before, right? We've had SARS, we've had H1N1, bird flu, swine flu, and we've had reactions to them before, right? There's a lot of people forget in the last 5 years, there was a year where 1,600 schools were closed in the States, right? To prevent an outbreak.
Yeah.
So these actions on their own aren't too far out of the ordinary. What seems a bit more than out of the ordinary recently is the coordination of all levels globally. And so from what I've seen, like, say someone does get this virus, for like you said, for the vast majority of people, it's like a bad cold or a type of flu. And unless they develop, you know, basically full pneumonia from it, the vast majority of people recover, no long-lasting health effects. And it's, you know, it's a couple week flu. I had friends who got the swine flu the year that it was going on, and everyone was very afraid of swine flu. Two of my friends got it. They were a couple at the time. They said it was a shitty flu. Mm-hmm. They got through it, lasted about two to three weeks, and they're better and they're fine. But there's a lot of fear, both, you know, with what are you going to do if you get it? What are you going to do if you get it, but you don't have symptoms, but then you could give it to someone else? All the fear that I'm seeing be generated seems to be less focused on the actual harm of the virus itself, at least in popular culture and media, and more about the responsibility of those without it to take drastic action in modifying their behavior to prevent anyone else from getting it. And that's where you're getting these lockdowns. But again, which in the short term totally makes sense. Like if you want to stop the spread of an illness, then yes, you know, enforce mandatory, I don't know about curfews, but get people to stay in their homes over the incubation period, you know, and if you're doing a good job at that, then a month later, or like in South Korea, numbers should fall, new cases should fall. And that's responsible public policy. But the extra information where my genuine concern is now away from the virus and its effects, and less around people spreading it and their responsibility, and more about what long-lasting societal changes will the powers that be want to be implementing, because that's what happened after 9/11.
Yeah.
Right? And so I don't even care if it's a man-made disease or any of that conspiratorial stuff. I just care about, am I going to have to wear a digital bracelet like in the movie Contagion to be able to fly somewhere?
Right.
Is there going to be this extra layer? Like, we can't take liquids on a plane anymore. Seems like a small deal, but we've been dealing with that for 20 years. But for the first 2 or 3 years, it was ridiculous. It was like, what? I can't bring my little cologne on the plane. Ooh, how does this save us from the terrorists? So,
but then it was normal, and then it was accepted. Right. I mean, in
over time. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you had a period of, you know, you had a period of intense fear, I would say, as I remember it, for about 3 months, right? And then things started to level off, and there was just this vigilance about it that continued for years. And during that time, all of these things were accepted. So yeah, I mean, I think it's a real concern. I think it's something that people do need to be talking about. And I guess it just comes down to the strategy for outreach, right? Because, I don't know, I mean, I felt like the country was primed for a major upheaval before this happened. We've all been watching this since 2016. This, in a way, might bring, I was saying to a guest of mine in a show I still haven't released, that I don't know if there could ever be another unifying event in this country because of political and social polarization. But if there is, this is it. You know, if there can be, it's this.
Yep.
So,
how people, I still don't see prospects for people unifying around that idea of stopping overreach and having that overreach become permanent as a result of this. So, yeah, I think it's all very worth thinking about. I don't know what anybody can do about it right now. Aside from the fact of, you know, in this this is a crisis where we all know people, we all interact with people. Those of us who are aware of these things, we lead real off the internet, outside of books, away from, you know, whatever conspiratorial media we consume. We interact with real people, and it's a chance to model, to feel, to calm yourself, and then to model preparation the best you can. Like I said, I'm still trying to find the right balance. It's tricky. But if you can do it, if you can be out ahead of this, like I've said in maybe previous versions of these conversations with Nick and Nick, you know, people have said to me, well, I heard this or I read this, and where'd you read it? You know, the New York Times, I saw it on Fox News. And it's just like, okay, you're at the same step as everybody else. The people who are, buying 20 rolls of 20 packages of toilet paper at Costco, you're at the same step they are, if that's what you're doing. And I just, you know, really encourage the people close to me to try and get ahead and to try and change their behavior. Number one, because of the social upheaval, but number two, because they're also older and there is like a potential threat. Like I said, act as if the I don't want to call it alarmism, but the people who are taking this most seriously, as far as like the projected rate of increase, the incubation period, number of people that a non-symptomatic person could infect, like take all of that seriously right now, but do it calmly, have a way of reassuring yourself that if you just do the right things when you're in public, when you have to be, and try to avoid that situation, just take the proper precautions, that feels better, right?
Yeah.
But then to also like try to be a step ahead of the information that everybody else is getting.
Absolutely. And I think, I think there's a huge difference between worry and panic.
Yeah.
And panic is like, it's like worry with uncertainty and no plan. Whereas worry is like a natural state of reflection of like, hey, these are not normal circumstances. I should be concerned. So having calm concern, which can come across as worry, I think is fine if it leads to action rather than paralysis. So like one of the things, one of the first things I did when I went into quarantine was that the first night, actually, I got together with my family after talking with my wife, and we were like, do we have a plan? Like a plan, if we had to just all of a sudden get out of the city for any reason, right? Whether it's an earthquake or pandemic, whatever, do we have a plan? Like that we've talked about and like, what do we do? I realized we sort of loosely do, but we never had like something concrete. So family meeting that night, talked about what we'd need, what we'd gather together, what we'd do if we were apart, and how we'd get together. And then once we're together and we have all our supplies and our necessary equipment, where would we go? And so now that's all sorted. And so just having that knowledge of like a solid plan for the people you care about, that's one less thing I have to quote unquote worry about. Now it's out of my mental RAM. And if I have to bring it in because the situation arises, great. But I'd rather have a plan and not need it than to need a plan and not have it at all.
Yeah.
So if things turned crazy, I know where I would go. And before that was more nebulous because it didn't feel like anything real could happen. And so if anything, the last month or so has been quite surreal. And I have felt that sort of, if you want to call it surreality, but I've talked with Rich about this at length, where with 9/11, it was this traumatizing event. And in a period of trauma, people are more suggestible. And so right. That's kind of what I see is happening is if you weren't watching the media and you weren't on the internet, then this is going to seem like much less of a big deal because that there's a constant broadcast of not just worry, but they've turned it up to 11 to turn it into fear. So if you're under 60, if you don't have any pre-existing medical conditions like previous pneumonia or bronchitis or whatever, And if you're relatively in good health, not, you know, morbidly obese or suffering from immunodisorder, then right away, your chances of mortality from this thing is like extremely low. It's even my brother said any young person that's passed away from coronavirus has had pre-existing comorbidities like 100% of the time.
Yeah.
They've already had pneumonia, they had bronchitis or whatever. Otherwise, there's not a lot of people under the age of 40 who are developing strong symptoms or deadly symptoms. However, we all have people in our lives that are older that we care about who we don't want to see get sick or to lose them. So I think that's where the biggest chance to sort of like serve those people that we care about who happen to be older. And that's where I see the social distancing and all these things as a useful tool. Mm. It's just that there needs to be perspective and there needs to be a sunset to all these social modifications. You know, a sunset clause, as it were, because it's very easy when people are in this fear-based or fear, heightened fear, traumatized state of mind that, yeah, a lot of new social norms or new laws or new regulations can be passed that we wouldn't normally accept, but because everyone's in a heightened state, then they go, yeah, that'll be the solution. Give us more of that. And then once the genuine threat or the genuine problem dies down, those social controls are still left in place just in case, so we can prevent it for the future.
And this can happen, and this can really happen to all of us too. Like I'm certainly not, I'm in total agreement with you, but certainly not from a perch, you know, like my level of anxiety about this changes regularly. And like the end of last week when they start talking about, you know, the malaria drug, hydroxychloroquine, as a potential mm-hmm. treatment, you know, yep. my first thought is, okay, well, how do I get hydroxychloroquine? How do I get a store of that? Right. And not what is it? What's in it? what does it do to you? You know, like those kinds of questions. If I do get it, what's the trustworthiness of the supplier? What's the quality of the supply? Those weren't the first. But then it's just like, wait a minute, this is, I understand this is a fight or flight kind of response, right? Mm-hmm. There's no thinking. This is stimulus react. There's not a lot of thinking or deliberating going on in this process. I mean, that was like last Thursday or Friday. I felt that way. So I totally get that. I'm very sympathetic to people. At the same time, you know, for the last 4 or 5 years, you know, I'm like a pretty libertarian, live and let live, individualism. Like that's certainly a message of school sucks, but for years, and I think I've talked about this publicly, there's been a bit of a wrestling match between my libertarian ideals and my observations of fucking people in the real world, you know?
Yeah.
And now this is like WrestleMania, this situation for those two conflicting, well, the observation and the ideals conflicting with each other. I mean, this is SummerSlam. So, yeah, I think that's something that I'm also trying to like mediate with myself every day as well, where, you know, I'm in New Hampshire. Nothing bad has, and I'm spending a little bit of time, like if I just, you know, try to get out in nature, get to the ocean, I go to Maine. Nothing bad's ever happened here. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, like nothing, it's an incredibly peaceful place. People come here to retire. People come here like we did in 1980 to start a family. It's quiet, safe. And it was actually the reason why, you know, I lived in Pittsburgh, and I don't want to make anyone listening to this feel like if you're facing this situation and you're in a city, there's no way for you to be safe or you're doomed in a city. That's not the case. No. I had the option of going somewhere else where the population was more dispersed, where there were two distinct networks, one, the Free State Project, and the other, the relationships that my family has built in this community for 40 years. So there's a lot of trust versus being in a city where I knew a handful of people and we were all dispersed throughout the city. And I was surrounded by areas that were poor and desperate. I lived in an okay area, but you know, that's not where I wanted to be when something like this happened. So my plan was to leave if something like this ever happened and I knew where I would come. I didn't know exactly how everything would play out when I get here. I don't love the current you know, accommodations, but it is what it is. And I think it's much better than it could have been. So, what was the point of all that? How did I get off on the leaving?
I think it's about,
sorry. Here it is.
Yeah.
Come here where nothing bad has ever happened. And you see people acting like this is no kind of a thing, right? Like, it's not going to happen here. It's not going to happen to us. There's 100 cases in New Hampshire today. One person has died. Last weekend in Maine, there were 5 cases. Today, there's 100 in Maine, you know? And you still see this normalcy bias where people just aren't enough people. I mean, you go out, it's pretty bare out there. You're driving at 5 o'clock. There's not a lot of cars on the road. But you do still see plenty of people going about business as usual. And that's disconcerting. And, you know, it's like, when are these people, what is it going to take for all of these people? Like, I, you know, just driving through the fairly populated areas here today, the supermarket parking lot is full. The liquor store parking lot is half full. You know, The only place I feel safe is like GNC, because it's always empty and it's always the same lady in there, and she's very helpful. Just as I go in to immediately stock up on like supplements and meal replacement powder.
Essentials for, you know, the situation, right? It's, but it's not an unreasonable response. Like, I think everyone, if they had a choice, would want to get away from reaction and go towards response and have a well-reasoned, well-thought-out plan. But as information's new, and as, like you said, you can't help but observe that some people are being, whether it's in denial or ignorance or they just don't care or it's apathy, there's like, I don't know any of these people who aren't taking it seriously. Almost everyone I know is taking it seriously. My son isn't taking it as seriously, but that's more because he's cynical and young and just thinks this is like, he thinks this is a transparent attempt to increase social control, and that the virus is less of a threat than people. And he may or may not be right, but so far, again, we don't know a single person who's been infected or whatever, but my brother's at the hospital where there's definitely people who are infected. So my wrestling match is between wanting to take this seriously as a genuine threat versus knowing that this could be an inflated threat because of the social, you know, our so-called social controllers' desire to take any threat, blow it up so that, like you said, they're waiting in the wings with solutions to monetize, to offer for that threat.
And it doesn't even require that, Paul. You know, I mean, like, they have such a ready and willing ally in the media, right?
Yeah.
And you know, I would say to a certain extent in the medical and the pharmaceutical industry as well. And it's not even like they had to collude to do this. It's just natural that the media, CNN wants people in front of their TVs, just like people were in front of their TVs for fucking Operation Desert Storm and 9/11, you know, and Oklahoma City. Like, this is a proven model.
Yeah.
So they're just doing what they do. It doesn't require any conspiring. But yeah, you're right that is certainly contributing to it and will actually lead to people asking for it. Whether they're asking for it explicitly, like, you know, I see people I've had a lot of disagreements with on Facebook over other political things, basically posting, government, lock me in my house. Like at about that level. And then there's people who are asking for it by, you know, the business as usual behavior that I've seen in New England. Yeah. So yeah. And it's probably going to lead to what we've already seen in California, New York. I think Connecticut did it today. It's certainly coming here. Massachusetts did it today as well. Massachusetts was a real hotbed for this. So it's coming to New Hampshire, it's coming to Maine. And if it's not where you are yet, I think, like, you know, increased measures are arriving there soon.
Yeah, with BC, we're considered like we were the first place to have a confirmed case. We're the first place to have a confirmed death. Incidentally, like 80 to 90% of the deaths in British Columbia have all been at elderly care homes, or people in related to healthcare and elderly care homes. So like the first 7 deaths we had were all in the same facility of people who are all over 75. But if you didn't have that context, you'd be like, oh, it's everywhere and it's affecting someone. But it's a very, very small pocket, or very, very small pockets. I guess they would call them clusters. So again, it's like I'm verified that, you know, the danger is real, but am I going to be personally affected versus infected? I'm much less worried about infection than I am affection, like affectation by the circumstances of how people are, right?
Yeah.
Whether they're, yeah, panic buying or, you know, get out of my way, I have something to do. Because a lot of times these traumatic events can be a stimulus to bring people together, for them to rise to the occasion. And for other people, it brings out the worst of them because they think it's chaos. So they're like, oh, finally I can be my, I hate to use the word anarchist in that context, but like what someone thinks an anarchist is, you know, like I was going to go Mad Max style. And that's not where we're at all. Right.
Right.
So I wanted to read a little statement my buddy sent me, which I don't know if the numbers are 100% true, but I just thought this little statement contextualized things in terms of whether we should be more afraid of the virus itself or the panic surrounding the virus. So he said, between 9 million and 45 million illnesses, between 140,000 and 810,000 hospitalizations, and between 12,000 and 61,000 deaths annually in the U.S. are associated to the regular flu every year. Okay. From 2013-2014 season to the 2016-2017 season, so that's 3 years, 68,000 people died from the flu in Italy. That's on average, you know, around 22,000-23,000 people per year of the flu in Italy. During those 3 years, no one self-quarantined, no businesses closed. The media never created a bit of concern for the victims. People of all age groups died, not just the sick and infirm. No one felt implored to stay home to save one elderly person. No one took place in social distancing. People regularly went out in the world sick, whether they knew it or not. Now, when these immoral entities that claim authority that no one should ever trust, from the governments, media, multinational corps and banks, military, drug and spying tech companies, essentially the whole military industrial complex, use the dodgiest of testing from the dodgiest health organizations to pump up the numbers, like 35,000 cases in the US in the first quarter of the year, and then say that because of this, we need to suddenly have a moral discussion about cash, guns, vaccines, public gatherings, then you can bet your bottom dollar that you're being had. And he says, I'm sure there are many people that are suffering in this disease or another has hit them very hard, but even the most inflated stats don't justify the overblown reactions and their supposed presented solutions.
Right.
So is my friend like underestimating the effect of the virus? No, I don't. I think he's just putting it in context of, should we be freaking out like this? Or is this a manufactured freak out?
So, okay. And yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
So whether the efficacy of the virus and the spreadability, take that as one issue. It definitely exists. It's definitely, you know, deadly to a certain percentage. That exists over here. We're all doing our best to avoid that or deal with it as best we can. Separate from that issue, but related, is public response or public reaction. And he's obviously speaking in the sort of Hegelian, like, dialectic style, right? Where it's like, the virus is the problem. The reaction is to freak out. Here's the solution, more social control. People have been talking about that for years. People have been doing that for decades, right? So, and knowing those facts doesn't necessarily help. It doesn't make me feel better. So instead, what's made me feel better about this? What's made me not feel like I need to lose my mind? Because I already went through that last week for a day or so. It's not fun, right?
Yeah.
Feeling helpless, that's the worst feeling, right? Especially when you have like family and people you care about like with you. And they're like, what do we do? Or they think you're the reliable source of information. And you're like, I know as much as you at this point.
Right.
Yeah. So I think there's steps, right? And it doesn't involve panic buying. But it's like there's lots of steps people can take to maintain their own health, to remember that they have an immune system that for thousands of years, we haven't had vaccines. We have had these diseases. They do come. They do affect people. But think about what we do have that we didn't have 100 years ago, right? That the Spanish flu, the flu of 1918, spread so quickly because World War I was going on and there was very little refrigeration and vaccinations really, if they're even a thing, were in their infancy. So the world was primed for an outbreak like that at that time. And so when people compare it to now, 100 years later, and go, it's just like that flu, then I can't help but point out the huge positive differences that sadly don't exist for everyone in the world, but at least in Western society, in Europe, increased sanitation, hygienic awareness, refrigeration, food quality, although that might have suffered a bit, but access to, like you said, supplements, vitamin D, vitamin C, there's all these avenues to boost our immune systems and refrain from immune suppressants. Yeah. That can you imagine if someone said, hey, if your immune system's at 1,000, that's not a real number, but like some metric, if it's at this point, coronavirus can't touch you.
Yeah.
If someone made that statement and could back it up with science, there would be so many people rushing out to get a hold of the substances and whatever, or do the behaviors, whatever they had to do to get to that threshold. Right. And then the rest of us would be like, I can't do it or whatever. So I think if you remember, like you said, to reach out to the people you care about, you use this quote unquote crisis as an opportunity. That's what the elites do. They use the crisis as an opportunity. Me, if I have to go home and I'm going to be quarantined after today, I'm going to work on my book, or I'm going to take my wife out on a house date. Yeah. You know what I mean? There's like a lot of things you can do, but the biggest thing I notice is it's this, I don't want to call it a shutdown, but this current situation is allowing me to have deeper, longer conversations with people who suddenly have the time.
Yeah.
That I haven't had, been able to have. The opportunity hasn't been there before. So there's a lot of constructive things we can do, and it's okay to have worry, but if you get to talk to other people, a lot of times that itself inoculates you, yourself, and them from panic.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really well said, Paul. And you know, when you're comparing 2020 to 1918, that was you know, something that people didn't have was the means of safe connection instantaneously, you know, and we have that, and we should be using that. And I catch myself, you know, like I'm on my phone and my phone does a lot of things. And every time I pick it up and turn it on, I forget why. I like 3 seconds later, I was like, why am I holding this? What was I supposed to do? But now it's about prioritizing connection, just texting somebody back, not resigning myself to like, oh, there's too many emails or there's too many Facebook messages, and I'll just pick them off slowly when I can. Like, that's my priority when I pick up my phone. Do I still wind up doing other things? You bet. But, you know, I'm trying to make that the number one priority. And yeah, I think there's an extra challenge here where, yeah, we've faced crises before, and things that induce a lot of fear and things that will bring out the best and the worst in humanity. The incubation period of COVID-19 is a very scary thing, right? And if you do have to interact with people, it produces an enormous layer of challenge beyond things like 9/11, where it was as comparatively simple as seeing somebody in a turban or seeing somebody with strange facial hair and saying, is that person Al-Qaeda, you know, in 2001. Where now it's like potentially anybody, you know, could be the person carrying it. And I'm not saying that as like, be nervous about this, be scared of this. Like, I'm reminding myself as much, because I need it every day, that is a social challenge, right? That could unravel a lot of things really, really quickly, as like trust, that trust that we all just kind of go through life with as we hold a railing going up a flight of stairs in a public place is gone. And that's going to have like a psychic impact on everybody. And just to, you know, turn up our consciousness about that, I think is a really important thing in supporting all of the other things that you're talking about, right? Because if other people make us afraid, you know, that potentially has a costly impact on our wellness, physical and mental as well. So it's just an extra thing to be aware of. It's an extra challenge that I haven't heard anybody talking about, like in the media, like they say social distancing, but
that's like all just a proximity thing, and it's not an emotional thing. And I think people just need to think about that. Like, you know, the first place I came and where I am right now in New Hampshire is my 70-year-old mother's house. Mm-hmm. I haven't been within, you know, we're a very affectionate family, all that. I haven't been within 10 feet of her the whole time I've been here, you know? And that has an effect. I've allowed myself to be within 10 feet of one person since I started taking this seriously. Unless there was mm-hmm. a situation like checking out in GNC where it might've been 6 feet or 5 feet, you know? Yeah. But that's a challenge, you know? And I think yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say it, one of the biggest challenges is self-regulation in terms of like, if we, you know, we might be trying to force ourselves to not let our worry turn into panic. And we might be aware of like, oh, if I do get too stressed out, it gives me a bunch of cortisol hormone, and that's going to lower my immune system, which will make me more susceptible. And it can be this like downward spiral. And I almost feel like if you can find somebody that you trust, who you're confident that you don't have the virus and they don't have the virus, or there's been a regular, you know, an incubation period, and you can give someone a hug because you know for a fact that neither of you are susceptible, hugging someone for 30 seconds releases a lot of oxytocin, which makes you feel better, which boosts your immune system. So I find it ironic that after 9/11, people were told to hug each other and to shop, right? Which are both dopamine and oxytocin boosting things. With this outbreak, we're being told you can't shop unless it's online.
Yeah.
And don't hug anyone for your health.
Yeah.
But both of which are, I get it, I get the advice, but it's way more debilitating to have to follow that advice. And like you said, the visual reference to who should I be afraid of was, yeah, you know, bearded people, brown skinned people, which obviously isn't the truth. It was just, again, what the media kind of put into our brains. And now, well, at least in Canada, we're being told to, you know, fear anyone with a mask.
Yeah.
And, you know, Trump anyone calling coughing. It the Chinese virus. Yeah, fear anyone coughing. Like, I was in a Starbucks 2 weeks ago, last Starbucks I'm ever going to get. But there was a lady in front of me, and she sneezed into her, you know, her elbow pit. And I was like, oh, good, she's practicing good hygiene. But then she started just coughing, and she's in front of me. She's like, ah, and I'm like, I was confused.
Yeah,
it's like, is she like, oh, that was good enough, but forget. And yeah, it was 2 days later, I started feeling not so good. And I was, there was a day of panic where I was like, did that, I don't know anything about that lady. And she's clearly Chinese, and maybe she was bad. So my brain is playing all these tricks. But then I got a hold of myself and said, okay, if that's the case, if that's the truth, what do I have power over, or what do I have control over right now? I can't go back in time. I can't prevent myself from going to that Starbucks. I can't prevent the lady from coughing near me. All I can do is take some extra vitamin D, take an Epsom salt bath. Before they closed our gym, I went to the steam room, because I know that coronavirus is susceptible to even a moderate increase in temperature, like 26, 27 degrees seems to kill it. So I was like, oh, let's go breathe in hot air for a while, right? I did get a cold, and it lasted a couple of days, but then I felt better.
Yeah.
Right? And if you have coronavirus, you don't just, unless you're Tom Hanks, you don't just have a mild cold for a couple of days and then get better. It's supposed to be, you know, fairly consistent with the symptoms, which is, you know, your dry cough, your headaches, your body aches, and your shortness of breath. Mm-hmm. And I'm had been at least a heavy cannabis smoker. So if anyone's going to have shortness of breath, it's going to be this guy. Not at all, right? Not at all. So just knowing those facts, measuring your symptoms, checking in with yourself, doing what you can to induce relaxation, because that's going to be good for your immune system. Mm-hmm. If you have to isolate, but you got a bathtub, when's the last time you had a bath? When's the last time you took some Epsom salt, put in that bath, and just soaked for an hour? All that shit's going to be.
Yeah. Oh, lots of tips coming up here, folks, too. There is like, you can just put a little Epsom salt like on you
too. Like you're it's like transdermally absorbing magnesium is kind of mm-hmm. the game here. So like if, you know, you're a single guy, you're 32, you live by yourself, you look at your bathtub and you go, no fucking way, no way, whatever, getting there. No, I mean, I've done it. I've taken Epsom salt baths. They're nice. But, you know, if you have some lying around, or you can probably buy it at an empty GNC, because what they're telling people, you know, on cable news is that there's no toilet paper, there's no milk, there's no meat. But no one's saying there's no, you know, there's no Nitrotech whey protein powder. So those, like, GNC is fully stocked. They have everything but liposomal vitamin C, right? They have zinc. They have, like, there's a, I think I was saying to Nick, when Nick Runlett and I talked about this last week, there's millions of calories in that place. Fairly affordable. That can be turned into delicious desserts. Or, like, delicious desserts if you use your imagination. You have to pretend a little bit. But, yeah.
Recommends.
Yeah.
Immune boosting, or at least calming, because if you can, it's not necessarily that you want to distract yourself so much as you don't want to let yourself get into a panic downward spiral, because it's easy to go down a rabbit hole, start freaking yourself out, or someone tells you something and you don't verify it and you start giving it credence and it's way off and that starts causing you panic. So like, I think the biggest opportunity right now is an opportunity for people to get to know themselves better. And really figure out not just what your priorities really are, like what would you do if this and this happened? Would you leave town, or would you want to leave quote unquote society if it became super repressive as a result of this? Those are just interesting questions to ask yourself. And then by having those check-ins with yourself, yeah, you can almost, I just kind of have a little trigger thing built in now where if I notice my hackles going up, or I start feeling sort of the onset of what I guess would be a panic attack or something, to reground yourself and prevent your brain from taking off.
What does that look like for you? What, if you say, cause I mean, yeah, I still, with all that I know, I can run away with that. And my, you know, I'll say, okay, well, we know what this is at this point, right? We know this isn't anything more than the automatic negative thoughts, but I still will go to like take melatonin, take valerian, take curcumin, like all, like mm-hmm. there has to be like, I'm taking something, right? Like that's,
yeah.
And that's sort of a force of habit of having like less constructive ways of dealing with anxiety. So still like going through the motions of like, don't feel well, put something in your mouth. you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But what does it look like for you? And I, like, I understand like the more preventative things, like you go outside every day, you look at, don't look at the sun, look, face the sun with your eyes closed, get fresh air, get, you know, moderate exercise. Those kinds of things are all preventative. Meditate, journal. We've been talking about that shit.
Yeah. Those are like the baseline. Those are just good advice for life, regardless of the situation. Right. So, if you have those habits already and you're, like, the reason yoga is so good for you is, to me at least, is less about the stretching and more about the breathing, right? Most people, when they go into panic mode, they hold their breath and your brain gets out of oxygen and you start to feel, for lack of a better
term, short of breath.
Yeah. It's the shortness of breath self-induced.
Well, you tighten up, it feels harder to breathe. It feels harder to take deep breaths in those situations.
When you tense up, right? Your muscles are constricting a lot. So, for biggest step, I used to make fun of people who would count to 10 and breathe because I was like, what are you, 5 years old? That actually works really well. The counting part takes your the left side of your brain away from whatever it is and puts it into just a loop, and the breathing part gets oxygen to your brain so you don't make dumb decisions. Mm-hmm. And then the grounding part, I mean, I used to live with a nice backyard. Now I'm on the 26th floor of an apartment. So I can't go just like put my feet in some dirt, but I can slide open the balcony door. And like I said, go out, have some fresh air. The sunlight is good because it's vitamin D. And these are kind of the winter months. So if you can't see the sun or go see the sun or get sunlight, get a bunch of vitamin D3. And I know everyone says take 1-2000 IU. I've been taking 6,000 IU every day for the last month.
Yeah.
And even though I did catch a little cold, it was gone pretty quick. My symptoms were very minor. And again, I was only quarantined because my work was like, you had contact with a person who had potential contact with a person with the virus.
Right.
We're pretty confident now at this point that neither of us caught it. And my 2-week window has passed. I didn't develop the 90% of the symptoms. So I'm either asymptomatic or I'm a lucky one.
Yeah.
So I'm still not going to go like visit my mom and give her a big hug and kiss for another 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Much to her chagrin, I'm sure. But I can still go home and kiss my wife. We have enough contact where it's like if either of us had something, we would have given it to each other by now.
Yep.
So I feel lucky and I feel somewhat prepared. What I want to do and what I'm hoping comes out of this conversation is that people feel it's okay to feel scared. It's okay to feel helpless. It's okay to have worry and concern. You know, you don't need to belittle people who are going through that. It's that if your concern is turning into panic or these like recurring negative thoughts, or obsessive sort of thoughts about, you know, terrible outcomes. Yeah, I think not only this few steps that we might have gone into, but do a little reading about, I don't know, what's a good thing to read that'll make you feel better. I find a lot of just context and a lot of perspective in situations like this helps, like, mm-hmm. In terms of like the adaptability and survivability of human beings. We're very resilient. Our immune system's this like amazing gift, and yeah, occasionally it doesn't always get it right. But the only reason cavemen were able to give birth in a cave and no medical supplies and somehow their babies survived, and animals do the same thing, you know, they're surrounded by bacteria, is because we have this amazing gift called our immune system, which most of us don't know how it works, but it's pretty amazing. It's pretty self-regulating, and unless we go out of our way to break our own immune system, which people do, mm-hmm. then it takes care of us the majority of the time. We can strengthen it and boost it and all this stuff. But the main thing is just to not wreck it, right?
Yeah.
You wreck it through heavy drinking and drugs. There's a lot, all kinds of avenues. Most of them are habitual. So again, is this an opportunity? Yeah, it's an opportunity to change your habits, but not for what the state wants, but what better serves yourself, right? It's a good excuse to not smoke or to cut down on drinking or to give your loved one a hug if neither of you are in quarantine.
Right.
And then most of all, to have these conversations about what's important to you. What are your values and principles? And even if we had this conversation, it got emotionally heightened, it would still be better than us having a conversation where we're both thinking about how we're going to die from this virus and having it be emotionally heightened because of that panic than us somehow disagreeing about something and it getting heightened. I would be very at peace with that. Because at least we're like getting somewhere. yeah. So I think there's an opportunity, but biggest thing is just keeping perspective and having as much patience as you can with those who are either less fortunate or less self-aware.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause yeah, it's very easy to be judgmental right now, but any of the people I know who are not taking this seriously, it's either out of ignorance or they're coping with it through denial.
Yeah.
Or
sure.
Apathy. They just sort of like, that's like people who just aren't into politics at all are just like, whatever.
Yeah. Or powerlessness.
This doesn't involve me.
They don't know what to do, you know, like maybe they're afraid and they see the supermarket parking lot. I mean, there could be a number of reasons why that would happen. Sure. Yeah, there's all that. I just flipped through my tabs and I remembered I had this article open. If anybody is just feeling, you know, health anxious, there's an article on Psychology Today. You can just Google it. It's called How Coronavirus Anxiety Can Make You Feel Sick and How to Treat Psychosomatic Symptoms When You Are Physically Healthy. And that's a helpful read if you kind of get caught up in all the fear of this and then internalize it. And I think what you're saying is great about just being more conscious. Like we are all practicing, I'm pretty sure I already said this in one of these shows, but we're all practicing higher levels of consciousness right now in just our physical routines, you know?
I bring something into the house from out in public. It gets wiped down. I wash my hands way more than I used to. And those are just like simple little practices, but it can extend into, you know, the experience of getting up in the morning and saying, okay, you know, we always plan our days, but if my day doesn't go according to plan, fucking whatever, you know, like, but now
it's not the end of the world.
Right. But I can get up and I could say, okay, there's going to be these potential situations where you might have to interact with another human instead of creating, which I have done, you know, a chain reaction where I'm visibly nervous or standoffish or even rude, like to a guy who tried to pump gas for me all of a sudden a couple of days ago, where I basically gave him a two-hand stop right there gesture just because I didn't know what he was doing. Anyway, shit like that happens. Yeah. And I, you know, I wasn't ready for that. I didn't prepare for that. So a man walks up and starts touching my car. And, you know, I said, whoa, whoa, whoa. Can I do this? And he said, I'm still touching your credit card and all that. And I said, okay, that's not what I'm looking for. And I drove on to the next place. There was a way to rehearse that where that guy didn't have to take my negative energy back inside with him and maybe transfer it to somebody else. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
Hopefully I can make up for it here with a, you know, a fairly constructive talk with Paul Verge and a smile for a lot more people.
The other advice is to not beat ourselves up.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
It's okay if you have a little moment of panic or a moment where you're like, oh man, I was a bigger dick to that guy than I needed to be because I was afraid. Like accepting that we don't have all the information, that, you know, all we are is a couple of guys talking and hoping something good can come out of this conversation that either saves somebody from some stress or gives them some perspective on things. Okay, maybe, you know, it is bad, but it's not as bad as I thought. And that's the thing. Lots of stuff is bad, but most of the time it's not as bad as you thought it was going to be because our brains are so creative. We come up with a big web of crazy outcomes and consequences. Yeah. But then the reality, at least I'd say the vast majority of the time, ends up not being as terrible as we thought. If only because that creativity has allowed us, again, to adapt and survive by imagining scenarios and then trying to plan around them.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
So I'm thankful for that ability, even if I have to keep it in check from time to time so as to not drive myself crazy. I would rather have that creativity to find solutions and not need it than to need that creativity and be disequipped.
Yeah, really, Paul, that's really well said. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much. I'm so glad that we got to talk today.
Yeah, me too.
Do you want to tell everybody Thanks. Where you are?
Yeah, I'm in Vancouver, Canada, but I'm physically at a film studio who I will not mention, but it is where I work, so it's not hard to figure out. I'm actually in a production office for a new movie by that gentleman right there.
Stephen King.
Yeah.
Which one of his books is it based on?
So this, the movie that's being filmed here, that's going to be coming out, well, we'll see if it gets delayed now, is a popular book, which has been adapted before, called The Stand, which is about a virus that wipes out most of the population on Earth and how some of the survivors are cool people and others are dickheads. Mm-hmm. And then how do those people interact?
Right.
And best and worst of humanity. So, you know, does that make Stephen King or Dean Koontz or any of these people who have written about viral pandemics, are they prophets or soothsayers, or are they just exercising that good old human creativity that we all possess? And a broken clock is right twice a day. So I think it's just more about imagining these different things that can happen, because stuff like this has happened in the past. Stuff like this might happen in the future, but we'll keep on surviving and finding ways to take advantage or opportunity and thrive and not let something like this get us permanently down. So
yeah,
I hope
it's interesting too.
Perspective.
Yeah. That these people, yeah. The perspective is really important in that these are people like Stephen King in The Stand who looked at things like this, that had happened before. I mean, we're not looking at The Stand here. I'm confident in saying that, right. Mm-hmm. Something that even if it rises to like a 2% death rate, that's not The Stand. And again, if people, you know, if you're in an area where if you're in Washington State or you're in New York or you're in Boston, Massachusetts, like go read the Diamond Princess Cruise article. And, you know, it's not an invitation to be reckless, but it's calming. It is, you know, that you have something that's just circulating the air of these people through this vessel for a week, and 17% of them walk away affected. And again, that is not to say don't take every precaution that you need to take in public, but just don't, you know, keep yourself up all night worrying about it. So, but somebody like Stephen King looks at maybe, I don't know, there was some animal flu in the 70s. I think it was the swine flu or the bird flu. There was, you know, the flu pandemic of 1918. And as a creative, especially, you know, in Stephen King style, what if it was much worse? What if it was way, 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 way worse? You know, that's an art form. But there are also people who have, you know, an art form of doing that under the guise of news, right? Or telling people what they need to know, and people who position themselves as the alternative media doing this as well. And a lot of noise out there related to that. So I think it's just important to be conscious of that and disinfect yourself from that as well. You know, spending a lot of time with my mom, you know, I want to just go down there sometimes and grab the remote if I would touch it, but I won't, and shut off the TV, you know. And she's actually done a much better job. She's finding ways to entertain herself, and she has she's actually in pretty good spirits about this. So, I think that's worth remembering as well. But geez, do I want to make you do impressions at the end? No, I don't think you have to. We'll have you
back. Yeah, I wish you luck. And it's like inoculate yourself from fear by listening to the School Sucks podcast.
Wow. Yeah. We'll have that at just at the beginning of every episode now until he sues us because people think it's him. So
that's great.
Yeah. I'm so glad we got to talk, and we'll definitely do it again in the future. Somewhere down the road, if you have a topic, hit me up and we'll do it. And I'm sure I'll be talking to you. And you know, I'm always talking to people from like the Tragedy and Hope and Autonomy community. So I'm
sure you'll be Autonomy.
Yep.
Loving it, loving watching it, loving being on the Discord and seeing the great conversations and all the great people. So Autonomy, we didn't mention it once, but people should definitely check that out. It's cool, and it just having graduated from first season is I can say is one of the key reasons why I'm not freaking out right now. I just got a lot of perspective and self empowerment from that whole course. So high recommends for that.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, then I will see you there. We'll talk more there. I do a Q&A, or it's kind of like a mastermind every Tuesday night, 7 to 8 right now, Eastern time. And people can just ask me questions. And I'm sure tomorrow night we're just going to be talking about this anyway. So
cool.
I'll see you there.
I'm working from home. Yeah. I will. I'll pop in to that tomorrow, and because I'll be at home. So I'll have a chance. Brett, thank you so much for having me on. Hi, how are you? And I hope your evening goes well, and that people who receive this transmission do well and take care. Thanks again.
Thank you, Paul.